Now, the new 940 Montreal presents The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Good afternoon, Montreal. And we're back with another edition of The Last Angry Man. This is Beryl Wiseman, Rick McConomy next to me. Yes, we know it's Super Bowl Sunday. Don't worry, Steelers by 7. You could forget the rest of the afternoon and listen in and get a little mad.
You're on. You're on.
You like that, Rick? What do you think?
Seahawks are going to take it, I'm quite sure, by 10 points.
Seahawks by 10.
Seahawks by 10.
Seahawks by 10.
Seahawks by 10.
You are taking the Seahawks over a dynasty, a legend like the Steelers. Johnny come lately.
Just because they win for a couple of times doesn't mean a damn thing.
McConomy.
Doesn't mean a thing. No. Seahawks by 10.
Very disappointed in you, Rick.
I know.
This is sad.
You're going to lose the nickel we just bet, right? We bet on the air.
Very, very disappointing. Montreal, today, I don't know. It's been a hell of a week. We don't know what to attack first. The Pollyannish, slavish acceptance by Canadians of this wonderful $50 million Gomery report, or do we discuss the paranoid lunatic fringe that seems to be sweeping most of the world because of a cartoon? Rick, what do you...
We need a choice here. We'll be doing both, and I know, you know, I went out to a dinner party last night. It was wonderful. Sat around the table, and I looked at people and said, 18 recommendations. Can you tell me one recommendation from the Gomery report?
What did they say?
Oh, the first guy said, yeah, I know. The deputy minister is supposed to talk to the minister, but they're not allowed to talk orally. They're only allowed to talk like in writing.
Wait a minute. They're not allowed to talk orally?
No. They have to talk like in writing. So, you know, Mr. Minister, good morning. Sign off. You know, deputy minister, good morning. Sign off. It doesn't make a bit of sense, and Canadians have got nothing out of this.
I particularly like, now, for you Montrealers out there, you know, some of you may know that my background in politics goes back to the Trudeau years, but Rick goes back to as a young man,
Maurice
Louis
Duplessis
Saint Laurent.
Time, yeah. Maurice Duplessis.
So he's wiser, sadder, but wiser. What I liked was no political aides get to give orders. Now, like, that's going to happen, right, Rick?
Well, I hope so, because I just hope our entire government is not being run by political aides deciding and then telling people what to do.
Right, and also we don't want the political officials that have been elected to go and tell any ministers or bureaucrats anything, because that way the people that are elected by all of us would actually be responsible for what they're doing.
Oh, well, they're too busy.
We don't like that, right? We're Canadians. We don't like to have that sense of responsibility, right?
Yeah, I think this country was based on deniability, and I think we've come the absolute full circle, right? We are now at the ultimate. We've studied the whole thing, and we have recommendations that have nothing to do with the people, have nothing to do with, I have a program, I'd like to get it sponsored by the Canadian government. It has nothing to do with getting the Canadian flag and the rest of it out there when we're living in Quebec, when the fleur-de-lis flies over every single nickel spent by the provincial government. But here we are.
We're going to put our government in some kind of a mountain and hope for the best. Montreal, we'll be right back right after this and tell you about the show today and who's coming on.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Hello again, Montreal. We're going to get back to Gomery. We're going to get back to discussing the new Harper government and what we can expect. We're going to get back to a discussion of the end of what I call Canada's Nixon era. But right now, we're going to deal with something that I think has not only international import, but will affect us here at home. We've seen two very important events and parallel events in the past week that relate to the Middle East and that relate to the threat of fanatical Islamism. President Bush, in the State of Union address, sent a message, clear message to Iran, that the development of the nuclear program without proper oversight, non-cooperation with the United States, with Western powers, with the United Nations, his calls for the destruction of Israel, are just not going to fly anymore. They're not going to be acceptable anymore. Toward the end of the week, you see it on your TV screens today, and we want to know what you think about this. You've seen the Muslim world aflame, Danish embassies, Scandinavian embassies this morning being burned because of a cartoon. If there was ever a clash of cultures, it is what we're seeing the past week. People who are confusing the idea of religious freedom and respect for all religions with obedience and obsequience to one statist faith. And that's not what we're about in the West. And that's the major clash that we're going to be facing, and we may be facing it sooner rather than later. And we're going to talk to two people about that right now with particular first-hand expertise. The first will be Amir Tahiri. Mr. Tahiri is a leading scholar, writer, columnist on the Middle East, particularly on Iran. He was born and educated in Tehran. He's written for the Daily Telegraph, The Guardian. His columns are syndicated worldwide. He's contributed to the International Herald Tribune. As early as the late 80s, he wrote one of the first studies of Islamist terror called Holy Terror, which was an international bestseller. And if anybody can tell us a little bit of the political and sociological aspects of what is going on in today's Iran, it's Amir Tahiri, and he joins us now from London. Welcome, Mr. Tahiri.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Mr. Tahiri, you've written recently, and it's a beautiful line, so I want to give it in full. President Ahmadinejad is a monster who feeds on external conflict. The answer is not to lead him to a banquet table, but to let him gradually starve. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, the present Iranian regime, I think, has provoked a crisis that could no longer be ignored through ordinary diplomacy. You know, the game that they have been playing for the past 25 years is over. So how is the outside world going to deal with this threat? Some people urge military action, for example, the bombing of Iranian nuclear sites. That would be ineffective because those sites could be reconstructed very quickly, even if we know where all of them are. Others are speaking of the continuation of diplomacy, which would produce or perpetuate the present situation. The third option is to put the squeeze on this regime politically, morally, economically, while also supporting the democratic forces that exist inside Iran.
The democratic forces in the last election, many observers at the highest levels of governments in the West were very surprised because they expected the women's movement and the students who were in open opposition in the streets against the regime to have more of an effect than they did. Why do you think they didn't?
Well, because they didn't have a candidate of their own. You know, the Iranian elections are like elections, primary elections within the same party, because all the candidates are approved by the government in advance. For example, if I want to become a candidate, I can't. So there wasn't much choice. The only choice that the Iranian voters had was to vote for the outsider against the establishment figure, and this is why they voted for Ahmadinejad, because they thought, you know, he's a protest politician, and he would symbolize their anger at the mullahs because he doesn't wear a turban and he's not a cleric.
Yet he declared himself early on to be very much of an ultra-Orthodox believer, whereas the students and the women's movement wanted more liberal policies. Is that not correct? Were they not listening, or were they just paying attention to what we call in Canada the optics?
Well, you know, when you are in a house on fire, you might jump out of the balcony. You know, and the Iranian youth, women, and others were so desperate, you know, that the slogan was anybody but mullahs. You know, they didn't want a turban. You know, now if this non-turban is worse than the turbans, that's another story. So they wanted to register their anger at the regime. They voted for somebody who was an outsider and who had not had a prominent position within the regime at all.
And where does democracy go from here? Is there a hope that structure changes, or is it going to take some kind of radical movement to do that?
Well, there are lots of civil society organizations in Iran. Iran has a very old political culture. It had the first constitution and the first parliament outside Western Europe in 1906. It was in Iran long before many other parts of the world. So, you know, it is not quite alien. What is important is that the outside world, the democratic world, should stop supporting this regime and sustaining it in power as they have been doing for the past 25 years, so that there is a level playing field in which Iranian democratic and progressive forces could come together and fight the regime.
Amir, we'll be right back with you in Montreal. We want to hear from you about what you think can be done or should be done by the Western powers in the light of what Amir Tahari is saying of choking off Iran, and we'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're talking with Amir Tahari in London. We're talking about the Middle East aflame, Iran threatening to wipe out Israel, the balance of the Middle East, attacking consulates and embassies of Denmark, even Sweden this morning, from Syria to Palestine, through Egypt, for cartoons. Amir, we know the threat of Iran as a nuclear power. How does that tie in with what we're seeing when you talk about choking off Iran and making them realize a bit of reality and come to the table? How do you do that given what we've seen the past couple of days of a world aflame over a cartoon? Where does the Arab street stop and the chancelleries begin?
Well, you know, there isn't really an Arab street. These demonstrations are organized by political groups. These are fascist groups. They are abusing religion for political purposes. But let us go back to how to deal with Iran. I think the first thing to do is to apply the rules of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to Iran, because Iran is a member and a signatory of that treaty, but has been violating that treaty and cheating for the past 18 years. And the first thing to do is to remove Iran's privileged access to nuclear technology and material that is given under this treaty. If you violate it, you lose that.
And okay, but they're getting it from other countries. We know they're getting it from Russia, for example.
Yes, but Russia should also cooperate, because you know there is a consortium of seven countries. Russia is a member that are exporters of nuclear technology under the NPT. They are treaty-bound not to supply technology and material and equipment to countries that are violating the treaty or are outside the treaty. This is the first thing to do. The second thing to do is to install a regime of inspection of ships that go to Iran. This is can easily be done because the U.S. Navy is very strongly present in the Gulf of Oman and the Persian Gulf. Nobody knows what is going on and what is coming out. And the third thing is to impose Zimbabwe-type sanctions against the leaders of the present regime in Iran, to boycott them, to show that, you know, if they want to behave the way they are behaving and pursuing the policies they are pursuing, they cannot be treated as normal interlocutors, which has unfortunately been the case so far.
Is this really going to work, though? I mean, you write in some of your recent works, for example, that there's another struggle going on within Iran that perhaps is reflective in another way of the women's struggle and the student struggle, and that is the problem of Kurdistan and the Kurds. And we've had reports from Dr. David Romano, who's written a book from Cambridge University Press called The Kurdish National Movement, where he's saying that this Iranian government is now starting executions of Iranian Kurds. And you hint at the possibility of Kurdish revolt, is that perhaps not going to be more effective in destabilizing this regime than anything the West could do after countless diplomatic encounters?
Well, it would destabilize the regime, but, you know, the idea is to remove the regime, and that could be done eventually, ultimately, in Tehran, because Iran is a very centralized state, and the government, the central government, controls much of the income, the nation's income, through oil, and also it has the monopoly of violence, if you like, through the control of army and police, and so on. Unfortunately, the new president has been provoking the Iranian Kurds, the Iranian Arabs, the Iranian Turkmens, the Iranian Baluch, because Iran is a multi-ethnic country. So he is creating additional problems. But the central problem is how to bring about a change of policy or a change of regime in Tehran.
Amir had hinted at the fact that a lot of the students and the women voted for what they consider the lesser of two evils. Does this remind you of any other recent thing?
Well, my question to you, Mr. Tahiri, is this. Is there a parallel between the recent election of Hamas and the situation that you're facing in Iran, in the sense of the lesser of two evils seems to be chosen for reasons really that are far too complicated for the world news to put into snippets and quick 30-second bites. Is there a parallel between the Hamas election and the current regime in Iran?
Well, they are ideologically from the same root, but you know the situation in Palestine was different because, you know, Hamas won the majority of seats with only 40% of the votes because its opponents were divided. And also the Palestinian election was an open election. You know, there was no pre-approval of candidates, whereas the Iranian election was not an open election. It was closed only to candidates approved by the regime. And Mr. Ahmadinejad won the election with more than 60% of the votes cast. So he had more votes than Hamas, if you like, right, when he won. But, you know, ideologically, they are both from the same origin. These are people who believe in a clash of civilizations. They think that Islam must conquer the world one day.
Amir, I hate to cut you off just for a moment. We're going to go to news, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to ask Montrealers, what do we do with an outlaw rogue state? And we'll be back right after this with another special guest.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. 790-0006. We want to hear from you. We're talking about Iran. We're talking about the Middle East, the flame over a cartoon. We're talking about a clash of civilizations. Are we talking about the next war? You get fed up with constantly seeing these burnings of buildings, attacks on people because of some perceived slight that we in the West would take as normal freedom of expression. We've got on the line Amir Tahiri from London, author of Holy Terror, one of the first great important books on Islamist terror, a well-known columnist and author. And we're being joined now by Dale Watson from Virginia. Dale, welcome.
Thank you, Burl. Glad to be with you.
You know, there's a tagline to this show that says, the last angry man, Burl Wiseman, and the man who knows more than he should. Well, nobody knows more than he should than Dale Watson. This has been, he's had a remarkable career in security, including 24 years of the FBI. He was the first assistant director for counterterrorism. He was there at 9/11. He's been involved in every major investigation the last decade. It goes on and on. Needless to say, Dale knows whereof he speaks. Dale, we've been talking with Amir Tahiri from London about the diplomatic, the economic consequences of how to deal with Iran. But let me ask you, President Bush sent a message this week. The message was clear to Iran. 1982, Israel takes out the Osiris reactor in Iraq, but we know that America had a certain suasion with Saddam Hussein. Iran today, there's very little suasion. The Iranian facilities are spread out. How practical is it as a notion that anything could be done to take out this this nuclear capability?
I think you probably hit it right. It's not as practical. It's not as easy as if they were concentrated in one area. But this is a growing concern that the U.S. government and Canadians and our allies are going to have to address, that this is much more threatening than the Iraqi situation. So this thing's going to have to be looked at. They've always been a threat ever since the Shah was deposed. They took our American hostages, and we've always viewed them as being an extreme threat to the security of the region and to the United States.
Any talking to this guy, or is there some, if there's going to be any aggressive action against Iran, this guy could go anywhere?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's the problem with that. And unless there's a regime change, I'm not sure what the outlook is. Doesn't look very favorable for a diplomatic solution.
Have we increased our ability to understand the situation on the ground through through intelligence and through other methods that we know or we feel many of us were a little lacking the last time around?
I don't know the current situation, but in the past it's extremely difficult with that, and it's not an area where you can gain much intelligence on the ground. So it was a very difficult target.
Dale, Amir, we'd ask you to stay with us. Manshal, we want to hear from you. 790-0006. Are you afraid of the next war? Is this a world aflame? We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. 790-0006. We are talking about Iran. We are talking about the Middle East aflame. Is this the next war because of a cartoon? Because the president of Iran wants to drive Israel into the sea? We've got Andy on the line. Andy, how are you?
Hello there. This afternoon, I'm going to tell you something which is going to be a bit, you might call it extreme, but I say not what I want, but what will happen. By the end of April, maximum by the time of June, the Iranian installations will be bombed.
By whom?
Well, I'm not going to say. The two nations will do it in cooperation.
Well, take a shot.
Well, it's going to be United States and Israel. There's no choice. And the thing is this. You will find, even though the Soviet Union, Russia, is still supplying them and all that, but in effect, their existence is also threatened. You see, North Korea, who has the bomb, but they know that North Korea will never bomb South Korea.
Well, never mind North Korea. I think Russia knows its existence is threatened by its experience with the Islamist fundamentalists in Chechnya.
So, the thing is this. Now, the problem is very, the greatest problem is that the average Muslim, or who believes in the faith of the religion of Muslim, they have not spoken out what's happening. Because there have been...
Are you suggesting that what has happened, what we're seeing right now is an aberration or a lunatic fringe as opposed to being the...
No, unfortunately is that the average Muslim Arabic Muslim population and all the Muslims who believe in Muhammad or the Prophet, if they don't speak out against what some of the certain factions of the Muslim religion, the people are doing, that means they sort of agree. Now, it will also create a reaction. Look, there have been, I've seen a lot of cartoons against the Vatican, the Vatican with the Pope, and only sinners are out, you know?
Sure.
Now, I also seen Jesus with their disciples on a cartoon where it says, Swingers Club, men only.
In the 60s and 70s, we saw Jesus as a peacenik, and during the oil crisis, we saw that famous cartoon that's still making the rounds of Moses on Mount Sinai, Rick. You must remember this. He's getting the Ten Commandments, and then God's whispering something to him, and Moses is saying, wait a minute, the Arabs get oil, and we got to cut off what?
Yeah, so the thing is this, is that you have to realize that... that this is much more dangerous. In order to avoid a greater problem, you have to have a small war in order to avoid the greater war.
Or a small intervention. Andy, stay on the line with us. I want to ask Dale Watson, former director for counterterrorism of the FBI, a question. Dale, we know... Dale?
Yes, sir.
We know that Israel has bought 500 what are called bunker-busting bombs from the United States. How realistic is it that they could find all the sites necessary to use them if they wanted to launch a preemptive strike on their own? Because we've just the other, on Thursday, I believe, General Shaul Mofaz, defense minister, said Israel is nearing the end of its rope on diplomacy on Iran. Do those bunker busters work?
Yeah, they do work, my understanding, and looking at the data on it. And certainly that could be utilized, as it was utilized previously, as you well know, in the 80s. Yes, that's a real possibility, and I'm not sure at what stage they are in assessing that, and how long are you going to let this go on?
Now, we know that the nuclear facilities in Iran are in three places, Isfahan being one of them and two others. What do you think of the way Andy's been characterizing this as a little war? Is this a little war, or is this a surgical operation? Can it be kept to a surgical operation if needed?
Well, I think it could possibly be a surgical operation. I'm not sure that anybody's committed to surgically removing these at this point in time. But
they are.
It's not going to escalate. I would not think that if this occurs. But this is a very, very serious problem. And anytime you talk about that or move in that direction, you have repercussions on it. What would the reaction of the Iranians be if that happened? They have a very good couple of good services, the MOIS and the IRGC, who would probably, do something in the retaliation side. So you have to weigh all those in, and we'll see what happens here.
Is your evaluation, as Amir's is, that some kind of diplomacy and some kind of intervention or an embargo by searching the ships that are coming in to make sure the materials are not coming in, is that kind of thing going to work, or are we looking at the end of April the way Andy says?
I don't know anything about a time frame, but I know that embargoes and that sort of stuff is a long-term, long drawn-out process. And if you already have the materials in place, you know, I'm not sure that would accomplish much of anything. It would certainly keep from the resupply effort, but that takes a lot of time and effort. And it's a matter of how much will these the countries want to put on this thing.
Did the president seem that patient in his address to the nation?
I'm not real sure. It sounds to me like, this is a growing concern. I know it's a growing concern, but at the same time, the U.S. has pretty well got their hands full right now with the Iraqi situation. But yet, this cannot be ignored, Burl. If everybody turns and says, well, we'll get a U.N. sanction and nothing happens, I mean, you're going to be setting on a very serious problem.
Dale, Andy, stay with us. Montreal, is this going to be a small operation or is this going to be a small little war? 790-0006. This affects you. Let's hear from you right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. Dale Watson from Virginia, former counterterrorism director for the FBI. Andy.
Yes.
Small operation or small war?
It's a small operation.
You got 10 seconds.
No, the thing is this. Bush will not wait, and it will happen in April. I'll tell you why, because the winter season is over. The heating oil is going to be there. They won't need it. And the world will side with the United States in this case, because the existence of one small country destroying the whole world in a larger scale, it won't be allowed.
Andy, thanks a lot. We go to Tony. Tony, how are you? You're on with Dale Watson, Rick McConomy, and me.
You know what I think? I think that one of the main problems in this whole story is that every country nowadays wants a nuclear deterrent, and I think Iran is no different.
Yeah, but not every country is threatening to wipe another country off the map and throw its people into the sea.
I understand that. That is a stupid comment from their president. But
stupid? That's a matter of state policy.
I understand that, but let me complete the whole thought. My point is that right now, what happened to Iraq, if Iraq had an atomic bomb, nobody would have dared to attack Iraq right now.
Absolutely. But that's absolute nonsense. In 1982, Israel attacked Iraq. Iraq had a nuclear facility.
They didn't. Yeah, they had a nuclear facility. They were building something, but they didn't have a bomb. That was my whole point. Now, the problem is Iran, the biggest stupid mistake Iran is doing right now is threatening Israel and the rest of the world. But my point is...
Well, they're not threatening Russia. They're threatening Israel, and they're threatening to kill 6 million Jews and put them into the sea, to use the president's words.
I understand. All I'm saying is that one of the biggest problems in the whole thing is the fact that U.S. can attack any country right now who doesn't have any nuclear bomb or any deterrent.
You have a problem with America attacking countries like Iraq that kill 1 million of its own citizens, including gassing 300,000 Kurds.
What about North Korea? I mean, let's.
What about North Korea?
They're not doing anything. North Korea.
Well, excuse me.
North Korea.
Number one, I'm not sure that you're privy to National Security Council meetings. Number one, and number two, you can't fight on every front. And third of all, you know, whatever you may think about Bush, he sort of, you know, kind of brought democracy into three countries. Not perfect democracy, but he stopped a man from whacking 1 million of his own citizens. General Louis McKenzie, our Canadian hero, said on Toronto radio the other day, he said, what the hell's wrong with Canadians? We're counting every single body? We wouldn't have gone on D-Day. We're worried about 30,000 collateral deaths in Iraq? Saddam was whacking them 80,000 to 100,000 a year.
Listen, there's no perfect solution. All the problem right now
is one perfect solution is get rid of the tyrants.
Well, there are many tyrants in the world. We should get rid of Castro. We should get rid of North Korean, and that's the whole problem. You're not doing that.
That seems like
you're
a short
list. No, there's much more. What we're doing is everything is based on oil right now. Iraq was attacked because of oil, and that's the real reason.
Iran was not attacked just because of oil. The oil could have been controlled by America anyway, and it was controlled by international consortiums anyway. And it was controlled by oil for food, which we put into the sacred hands of the United Nations that Canadians are so fidel to, and they screwed it up.
Exactly.
So nobody, this wasn't about oil. This was about, you know, oil. If oil was part of it, it was about stabilizing oil because the U.S. succeeds where the U.N. fails. Tony, thank you very much.
Jack, you're
on.
Yeah, hi. Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I want to make a comment concerning the atomic bomb. Hello?
Well, the atomic,
no,
the hydrogen, or the neutron, or which one would you like?
No, my point is why Iran does not have and Israel has it. Why, you know, they don't let Iran to have it? Why Israel has to have it?
Nobody, Dale,
no,
correct me. Excuse me, Jack, hang on a second.
Okay.
Dale, correct me if I'm wrong. Nobody's saying that Iran can't develop it. What they're saying is they have to develop it within certain guidelines and certain reporting. And you have a president of Iran who's saying he wants to wipe a country out. That's why there's an objection to Iran having the bomb. Don't you get it? I mean, I have no problem with the cop down the street having a gun. I got a big problem with a guy who's saying he wants to kill 12 people having a gun. We'll be right back with you, Jack. Dale Watson in Virginia right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Now, the new 940 Montreal presents The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Montreal, we're back. Iran, the next war, the Middle East aflame. Dale Watson in Virginia, former director of counterterrorism for the FBI, specialist in international security. As a closing comment, what signal was President Bush trying to send? What do we take from the State of the Union address, and where do we go from here?
I think he was sending a very strong signal, as you've looked at Bush in the past, that he will go down the road for a certain period of time. I think he's telling people that he's not going to put up with this forever, and that sooner or later Uncle Sam will become angry at this and do something about it. I think he's putting people on notice.
Dale Watson, many thanks for taking time out
thanks,
on your Sunday. Say hello to your family.
I will. Thank
All
you.
The best.
I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Montreal, we're joined in studio now. I'm almost afraid to sit in this booth. I mean, I got two ex-Bataniers of the Bar of Montreal. Rick McConomy, as you guys know, is one, but I stopped giving all the kudos about him after the second week of the show. But now we're joined by Maître Pierre Fournier. Welcome, Pierre.
Beryl.
And we're going from the lunacy of the Middle East, to the Pollyannish false pieties of Canada. This week, as you know, Judge Gomery released Volume 2 of his report that we are going to get into. We're also going to get into the next hour of the new Harper government. We're going to get into the end of Canada's Nixon era with the departure of Paul Martin and hopefully most of his acolytes so that liberalism returns to the Liberal Party. We're going to start with Pierre, and we're going to start and Rick, and we're going to start discussing this this incredible report, and it hasn't received perhaps some of the critical analysis that it should have, but a report that says that aides to ministers shouldn't give orders to deputy ministers, that everything be kept in writing, as Rick McConomy says, no oral congress between aides and ministers. And all this in the name of political correctness and accountability and transparency in government. And meanwhile, we have Judge John Gomery writing the preface to a tell-all book authored by Francois Perrault, the PR guy for the Gomery Commission. I mean, can this country get any sillier? We're taking a lesson in ethics from a guy who ran a commission where he let talk whoever he wanted to let talk, dozens of cases of bias that I've pointed out enough in my writings, and all of a sudden, we get a tell-all book that he's writing the preface to. Montreal, Canada, how much more hypocritical crap are you willing to take? Let us hear from you at 790-0006 if you've got any self-respect left. We'll be back after this. We're going to have a little talk with Pierre Fournier and Rick McConomy. We're going to open the lines to you, 790-0006. And we want to hear from any of you who've got any self-respect left right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back in studio with Rick McConomy and Maître Pierre Fournier. And we're talking about the Gomery Report. And we want to know what you think of this kind of report that sets up this distance between our elected representatives and the citizens, that moves so much power into the hands of bureaucrats, that wants everything done in writing, yet which seems very, very nice in principle, and yet during the inquiry, people were stopped from answering questions, lawyers were stopped from asking questions. The Martin Power Center, who had been named, was never called to testify. And all of a sudden we get this wonderful Vestal Virgin kind of report, and the next day we see that Judge Gomery is writing a preface to a tell-all book by the PR director for the commission. Pierre Fournier, what do you think of this whole Gomery process?
Well, you're asking two different questions, Beryl. You're asking a question about the report itself, and you're asking a question about the process.
Let's start with the process.
That's the part that I'm most familiar with.
I think that's all the inherent rot starts with, that ends with the false piety.
Well, let's keep the words out of it. The process itself, and especially the process of somebody claiming to act on behalf of the commissioner as a spokesperson, and then claiming to write about what took place that didn't take place in public, that to me is just as wrong as Rick and I negotiating the settlement of a case. We fail, and then we go out and we blabber to the judge as to what we said during the settlement negotiations. There is a certain amount of give and take that takes place behind closed doors. That's what makes commissions of inquiry, trials, and other things work, and that's what allows people to go ahead with a process. But if you're going to tell all, as is threatened in that book, once the process is finished, then there won't be, in the future, that kind of give and take. And the process will just grind to a halt.
The inquiry process itself, is there not something in an inquiry process of one judge, a process that not intrinsically, but the way this one was manifested, had no due process in it. Is there not something questionable in the post-charter era where every government action is supposed to be governed by fundamental justice as set out in Section 7 of the Charter? Is there not something about kangaroo courts that just doesn't smell right?
It's been in our system for years, and one of the big things...
Pre-charter, though.
We've all looked at it. The coroner's inquest, where someone who's eventually going to be accused of a murder has to testify. Various other areas where that is.
But there was privacy protection in those. We're not talking about 20 million people looking at something.
You're talking about public and covered by the press. okay? And this is where the legal system seems to fail, that it can't control these special mandates that are given out where you destroy people's reputations, you accuse them of all kinds of things, and then you come down with your report, and your report is titled, for the second half, Rebalancing the Relationship Between Parliament and Government. Now, how many people got trashed, got accused of things, got badly done by, and then we come down and all this about is the relationship between Parliament and government? Where is the practical necessity of having gone through all the dirty linen?
Well, you know, Rick is right. The conclusions that the second report leads to have very little to do with the kind of evidence that was elicited during the first part of the hearings. But having said that, even during the first part of the hearings, there was very little way to see what our way was. I'll give you an instance, a personal instance. One of the first questions I asked from a witness, I was met with an objection on the grounds of relevance. And I said, well, look, it has to be relevant because it's right here in the subpoena that my client got. You're asking for this information from my client. Your lawyers are asking for it. Therefore, it has to be relevant if you're a lawyer. And the judge said, no. You should have called my lawyers. They would have told you they aren't insisting on this. If we, as lawyers, cannot see in advance what's going to be relevant and what's not going to be relevant, it makes our life extremely difficult. And that was a situation that lasted throughout. And I think, Beryl, you alluded to the fact that that Prime Minister Martin got away
with an exoneration in quotations.
Well, and more importantly, with the most feeble cross-examination
The most feeble definition of exoneration. I was stunned by the fact that Gomery said in his report, and this is exactly his words, we have to exonerate the Prime Minister because he said he didn't know, and since he said he didn't know, he must have been innocent. Now, since when is ignorance a defense to anything? If some poor guy on the street does something that's in violation of the criminal code, and he says, hey, Judge, I didn't know.
No, what Prime Minister Martin said was, I didn't know this was taking place, and that's what Minister Galliano said, that's what Mr. Jean-Pierre said.
This is what really ticked me off about the inquiry. We had Alan Cotler, the whistleblower, who blew this thing open, submitting two pieces of written evidence from the chief of staff to Martin in 94 and 96, asking for money from sponsorship. We have his Quebec assistant asking for $1 million for Serge Savard in 2001. We've got all this Bro's fourth day of testimony tying Jacques Olivier to Bro and telling Bro, go talk to Corriveau, he'll take care of me. We've got this massive of evidence in the record against people right around Martin, and Martin didn't know. It's not credible. And we'll be back to discuss the credibility of Gomery, the inquiry, the final report with Pierre Fournier, Rick McConomy. We're going to be joined by John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about the Gomery Report, Volume 2. Is this anything workable? Is this just something Pollyannish to make ourselves have that warm little cozy feeling in our tummies that we like to have as Canadians? Democracy Watch, our friend Duff Conacher, says this report fails to get to the heart of the money questions. It doesn't do anything to ensure that special reserve funds created by Cabinet and under control of the Treasury Board, of which Mr. Martin was vice chairman of, by the way, are in any way have any accountability. It doesn't strengthen any accountability provisions about money in the Federal Accountability Act, and it doesn't even address the question of offshore accounts, which, believe it or not, Mr. and Mrs. Montreal, are perfectly legal in our system between elections. Right in studio, by the way, we have Rick McConomy and Maître Pierre Fournier, and waiting on the line is John Ibbotson. We'll get to John in one moment. I just want to go to Harold. Harold, how are you?
Yeah, good afternoon. Very well. Basically, the whole thing was set up as a semi-whitewash because it's like everything typically Canadian.
Sweet. Harold, I love that term, but why semi?
Well, because Mr. Gomery, I don't want to say anything disparaging, he did his best, but there is a, what about people going to jail for stealing?
How about that, Pierre, Rick? Did Gomery do his best?
How come if you're a little kid and you go get two joints of marijuana, they seize your car?
They
seize all the property from those people. What about you steal from the public trust? You're in government 20 years. We take your house, your RRSPs, you're penniless.
Harold, between you and me.
Yeah?
Just you and me. I'm sitting here in a room with two former presidents at a bar in Montreal. Should I watch my wallet?
Yeah, you should.
I should, eh? So,
right.
Rick, Pierre?
Thanks, Harold. That's a really generous kind of thing.
What?
Yes, there were people that were lined up to be criminally charged. And I agree with you entirely. The problem with this is that there's a super ability to really focus in on things on the very short term. Unfortunately, you start making conclusions that are accusations, and then it just gets crazy. I mean, I agree with you totally. I mean, it's just nuts. You know, we didn't have any dirty money, but now we've found the dirty money, so we gave the dirty money back to the people that we should have given the dirty money back to. But who do you give the dirty money back to?
Huh?
You give it back to the politicians so they can go and spend it again in some other thing. It just doesn't work.
And then one guy gets, I don't know, this guy, he was found guilty. What does he do? He gets sentenced to go to university to teach kids business ethics? I can make up phony invoices.
Well, I think what's more important than his sentence, Harold, was the fact that all the charges were brought by RCMP investigation prior to Gomery. Harold, we ask you to hold on and be patient with us as we're joined by John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail. John, thank you very much for taking time out on Sunday to be with us.
It's a pleasure.
John Ibbotson is one of perhaps half a dozen gentlemen of the Fourth Estate, gentlemen and ladies of the Fourth Estate, who really have their fingers on the pulse of things. And I'm a big fan, so that's full disclosure. But, John, I got to ask you about, I don't know, today or tomorrow, or today or yesterday's a column. We're going to miss Martin's sense of wonder, and I know you didn't pick the headline. Somebody else writes the headline.
Well, I think we're moving a bit from Gomery, but I think...
Yeah, we are, but I saw the headline this morning.
Indeed. I think it was actually Friday's column. I think what we're going to miss about Martin, apart from the ineffectiveness of the government and his reputation for being unable to prioritize, and, of course, all the accusations and counter-accusations that came about during the sponsorship scandal. Beyond that, the guy had a sense of the potentiality of the country, of what it's becoming. He was at the end of a tired and allegedly corrupt government. He was himself tired towards the end. But the ideas that Martin was floating, often when he was finance minister more than he was prime minister, were ideas about what Canada can become, a very urban, diverse, tolerant society, and an explosively creative and entrepreneurial one. And I agree with that vision of the country. I think that's what Canada is turning into. Did he realize the rhetoric? No, too often not. But whatever else Stephen Harper is, he's not a man of rhetoric. He is a very practical, calculating man, and I think he's going to give us a very efficient administration. But it's not going to have the flights of rhetorical fancy that Martin was prone to, and that on his good days, I think he actually believed.
John, we'll be right back with you after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back and we're talking about the Gomery Report, Volume 2. Is it effective? Is it just something Pollyannish? We're on with John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail, and in studio, Rick McConomy and Pierre Fournier. John, I know that both Rick and Pierre had some questions for you.
John, I want to know, you know, you're talking about Paul Martin, the visionary during the time prior to becoming prime minister. I cannot remember hearing Paul Martin speak publicly before he became prime minister on a vision of the country or anything like that.
Well, I think there was a period, actually, after he stepped down or was fired as finance minister, depending on what version you accept, when he was sort of going around the country giving some speeches, and I think he articulated some of it there.
That was a leadership race, right?
And it was also, as I was going to say, it was also something that he was spending a lot of time in the leadership race. I want to emphasize, I think the reality...
Exclusively the leadership race.
Well, there were also, it was before the, I mean, there never really was a leadership race because neither of the two contestants was really serious.
Yeah, but the madness here in Montreal is a member of parliament, and many of us have difficulty remembering where we ever heard from him, what we ever heard him say. I mean, other than the fact that he took all the money out of the healthcare system, I don't know of another event, thing, or great speech that was made by Paul Martin prior to him getting speechwriters as a prime minister.
The great irony of it, of course, is that probably the best known speech that he gave before he became prime minister was the one, who do you know, in the PMO, in which he laid out what he thought at the time was a platform of reform of parliament. Again, that didn't live up to Ministry of the Reality, too. But
John, live up. You've written columns demonstrating how his PMO was even tighter control than Chrétien's PMO.
Indeed it was. One of the interesting...
Now, he can't blame all this on 35-year-olds around him.
No, but one of the interesting recommendations of Gomery is, and we'll see if it actually takes place, is the one that would limit the capacity of what we'll call exempt staff, unelected officials in ministers' offices and the PMO, from directing senior public servants outside the regular chain of command. I don't know whether
it seems unbelievable to me to suggest, okay, that happens over and over and over again, and it's a core problem in our system. I can't imagine a deputy minister having someone tell him, that some political person in the office telling him, this is what you're going to do, and that's an initiative that I am taking personally. It doesn't come from anyone else's backing. Pierre, I want to hear from you about trashing people and trashing individuals by the use of this kind of a commission.
Well, two things. First, to answer the question about the interplay between minister's office and the higher ups in the civil service. This doesn't happen because of a lack of necessity. The minister is just not there. The minister is off on committees, off on in his province doing whatever he has to do in his writing. And who runs his office? It's his chief of staff. And that's the person that the deputy minister will check with when the minister is not there. If that doesn't happen, there's going to be much less checking and much less politicians being involved in the actual responsibility of government.
Short segment, gentlemen. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy, Pierre Fournier in studio. We're talking about the Gomery Inquiry, fact or fiction. Feasible or not, and then we're going to be joined by several guests talking about the end of Canada's Nixon era and how to renew the Liberal Party before we get a peek, perhaps at the end of this half hour, at the new Harper government. Pierre, before the break, you were just in the middle of a comment about...
There was a second comment I wanted to make. I've heard John Ibbotson say that the old Liberal regime was the end of a corrupt regime. The caller before that, whose name was Harold, was talking about all the people who should have been put in jail. Remember that this is the truth as put forth by the Gomery Commission. The Gomery Commission was a flawed process as far as I'm concerned. It put out a version of events that is not, in my humble opinion, the version of events that is the only version of events that should be put out. But it was highly effective as a news-making organization, and that's what people now believe. I don't think it's fair to refer to the old Liberal regime as a corrupt Liberal regime, and I'm not a Liberal politician. I'm not even a card-carrying member of any political party. I just don't think that you can go from a flawed process to a conclusion and then assume that that is the correct conclusion forever.
What does it say about this country when we can abuse charter protections, and we can do what Rick called attacks by an innuendo and insinuation, where our personal liberties, our personal privacies, our personal rights in the charter haven't taken in our blood? What's it going to take?
The problem is we have a political system that has an arm, and it's an arm of inquiry such as this that occasionally get used and they reach in to put another spin that somebody somewhere thinks is needed to cover them. I mean, in the end, the Canadian people have delivered a very strong message to Paul Martin. And how much of that message is that hiding behind the Gomery Commission didn't make sense? One should have assumed the responsibility much stronger in the beginning, and then just carved out what had to be carved out. In the end, you've ruined a whole bunch of reputations.
In other words,
attacked all kinds of people.
It would have even been better if Gomery had said to Martin, "Well, we can't prove that you knew any of these ad company guys, but you had a responsibility to know." And then Martin could have gone on and made a checker speech or something like that.
Well, that kind of thing. But the thing that gets forgotten in all of this is that people managed to get a stadium commitment for the McGill Stadium for the Alouettes. They managed to sponsor all kinds of events going on in the country. They managed to sponsor the RCMP's musical ride, the Blue Nose. I mean, you go down the list of, and they made sponsorship sound like a sin or a crime on its own, that the fact that you were doing sponsorship was somehow criminal and wrong. So I think that they've taken this arm of government and used it and abused it, and I think the Canadian people have given them a big message.
But there's another aspect to what Barrow was saying. We have these fundamental liberties, and if we don't take care of them, if we let things like the Gomery Commission ruin people's reputations without doing anything about it, then I think our Constitution is a nicely written piece of paper, but it won't have any real effect on our lives. This is something that has to be worked at all the time. The protection of people's reputations, of people's liberties, is something that needs to be constantly fought for.
And this was a sideshow, and people didn't care as long as they were entertained on television.
Yeah, the lessons of the War Measures Act. I mean, there is a connection. There's a connection between the two. There's a belief that your political philosophy is the only one that's valid, and therefore you can go out, set the Constitution aside, set people's rights aside, and go on the attack.
Ed, you're on the line.
Hey, guys, how are you?
We're okay. How are you? So what do you think?
I think the Liberal government gets what they deserve. Listen, I'm not anti-liberal, I'm not anti-anything, and I'm not pro-conservative, but at the end of the day, I believe in smaller government. I think government has gotten way too big. The middle class in Canada is way too much. And when government has too much money, they just start wasting it like this.
Which part of the waste are you objecting to?
Well, for example, we wasted $100 million in sponsorship, and we wasted $160 million on Gomery.
Well, actually, they didn't find $100 million wasted in sponsorship, and Gomery cost about $50. But,
well, that depends on who you go with.
You're right, but so they spent 50 to find 50.
Yeah, so that doesn't make sense.
Which the RCMP had found anyway before.
I think that what Paul Martin should have done, and I used to be a card-carrying Liberal member, is he should have taken the blame. He should have waited until Gomery finished his report. He should have said, we acknowledge that something wrong has happened, we're going to make it right, and here's what we're going to do to make it right.
You believe he didn't know anything at all?
Well, I think he knew it. It just that he was being protected. Right? People wanted him to be the next prime minister, and they knew that if he was dirty, it would have been a much more difficult fight to win.
What riding do you live in?
I'm in Laval.
Which part? Which riding?
It's called Laval des Îles now.
You voted for the Liberal candidate?
I did not vote for the Liberal candidate because I don't think she got the job for the right reason when she was put in this area.
What are you hoping to see in the Harper government?
Well, what I'm hoping to see, you know, I'm a middle-class Canadian, I work hard. I'm hoping that they'll cut my taxes, which we'll see how they can do with a minority government. And I'm hoping that they're just going to cut social programs. I don't need the government to take care of me. I'm smart, I'm educated, and I work hard. What I need is a government that's going to give me the basic services that a federal government should give me.
Ed, if you can stay with us, we'll be right back after this. We want to hear more from you and other Montrealers, 790-0006, on what you're expecting from the government.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back in studio with Rick McConomy and Pierre Fournier. We've been discussing the old Liberal government. We've been discussing the Gomery reports. How much damage has it done to the country? How much damage has it done to your confidence in the country? And now we're pleased to have with us Toronto Conservative Senator Con Danino. Con, how are you? Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Beryl.
I just want to tell our listeners, this man is one of our finest public servants, not perhaps not as well known in Quebec as he should be, but I'm hoping that he will get better known. Khan, what can we expect tomorrow from in this new government? Any surprises that you're willing to share?
Yeah, first of all, I'll send you the 25 cents for the that I owe you.
Wait a minute, I thought it was 50 cents we agreed on.
No, you're only worth 25.
All right, fine.
I don't think so. I think Stephen Harper is going to deliver on the things that he made, his five priorities, very quickly. I'm certainly pleased that he's announced that the Accountability Act will be number one. You asked before how much damage has this whole scandal or all the scandals of the Liberals. I think it's done a great deal of damage. Certainly it's done a great deal of damage to the institution of politics. It taints and paints all of us with the same broad brush. And I think it's a shame because people need to have confidence in their officials, both elected and unelected, to be able to say we'll trust them to run our country.
Khan, that's so one thing that Stephen has, that the Prime Minister designate he seems to have already put a stamp on it. We read this weekend how people have been impressed with his manner, both in Quebec and Ontario, of getting, as you said, those five priorities, sticking to his priorities, where under Martin, as one writer said, we didn't know what the priorities were from day to day. And coming across, and I must say, I don't think I've ever been prouder in 10 years to be a Canadian when we heard him in his first press conference say to the Americans, you take care of your sovereignty, I'll take care of ours on the Northwest Passage. And then when he was talking about Hamas, saying bluntly, we'll respect the democratic judgment, but a democratic government to be legitimate has to renounce violence. And these were no equivocation, no I'm very, very disturbed, just straight out, here I am, let's get to work.
Well, I think what's happened is Canadians have started to see, and I think you'll see a lot more of it, what we who have known him for a while have seen. You see, I think you truly believe, besides being a very intelligent man, a very capable individual, he's a real honest individual. I think what you see is what you get. There's no nonsense about him, and I think Canadians are starting to see that, and I'm glad that you're pointing that out. I mean, after we've seen how many Canadians actually voted for this scandal-ridden government, I mean, I cannot in my wildest dreams conceive as to why so many people will vote for them. You know, you got Gomery called them thieves. The Liberal Party said they stole our money, and yet people voted. I think what they will see is a man who is diametrically opposed to the Paul Martins and the Jean Chrétiens, as an honest man who's there really with the full confidence and belief that he's going to make a difference to better the lives.
And someone not tied to the elites, as another profile pointed out.
I don't think it's tied to anybody.
You know, are you connected to a big enough network, or is it going to happen that just like it happened to Mulroney, the guys around him killed him?
Well, what is interesting is that if you take a look at what's happened in this election, is first of all, most people don't quite realize that half of the caucus is from Ontario, Quebec, thank God, and the Maritimes. And you've got people that fairly represent, I believe, the Canadian mosaic. My personal opinion, though I have great respect for him, as Beryl will attest, is that the worst thing that happened to Brian Mulroney is 211 seats. That was just too many people to please. And
a naivety factor, which I think you're exposed to.
Well, of course, but also the ego factor goes up, you know.
Khan, I have to cut you short. I'm sorry we're being pressed for time. I want to thank you very much for taking the time out on a Sunday to be with us.
Anytime,
and
Beryl.
I think we're going into an era where we're going to be patriots before we're partisans, and I'm hoping that that's what we're seeing from the Prime Minister designate, and with people like Senator Condonino around him, I have great hope for this country. I want to thank, first of all, Chris Bunbury, who's handled all our technical work today. I want to thank all our guests, Pierre Fournier, Amir Tahiri from London, Dale Watson from Washington, and the Globe and Mail's John Ibbotson. Montreal, thanks very much, and we'll see you next week.
Sundays from noon to 2, Beryl Wiseman is the president of the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal.